Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, my name's Nick.
Hello, I'm Woogie.
We are the Mouth of Manliness. This is a podcast all about mental health. But it's not just mental health. It's kind of about people's lives and about how they cope and how they manage in the world.
Yeah, and digging into the stories that make them who they are.
Yeah, so it's real life stories where we talk about things that people have been through and how they've managed and how they've coped and how they've come out the other side. So sometimes it's just me and Woggy here, but more often than not, we're talking to guests, sometimes more well-known guests, but more often than anything, it's just normal people who have been through interesting situations.
Yeah, and they've all got a lovely story to tell.
Yeah, so Mouth of Manliness, we are about mental health, but we're more about people and stories.
So, welcome to the Mouth.
The Mouth of Manliness. Welcome to the Mouth of Manliness. Hello, everyone. Welcome back. Season 3 of Mouth of Manliness. Good times. We are still in the midst of COVID. It's me, Nick Noyes, and my colleague here. You're going to say you are.
Woogie. Hello.
Woogie. And we've got a brilliant guest today, Barry Dolan from Oxygen Thief and Non Cannon.
You are
two things.
Yes. Oh. Two sides of a coin, perhaps. I don't know. It's not legal tender, but two different projects that I do.
It's funny because they're not a million miles away from one another, I didn't think.
No, I suppose they're both from my brain, but they're sort of different approaches, I suppose. So it's like, I've been doing Oxygen Thief for ages, for about, I don't know, 15 years or more, maybe, since university kind of thing. Just didn't have a band anymore, carried on playing loud on my own, and then turned into a band and things like that. I've been doing that for ages, and then I sort of had thought I'd have an experiment to see if I could write more kind of gentler, more straightforward kind of singer-songwritery stuff. All the sort of points where I would normally make certain decisions, I kind of went in a slightly different way, or you know, took a sort of handbrake turn against my usual instincts and sort of. So it's, yeah, they're connected, definitely.
Yeah, I like you've got violins and cellos and things like that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's really nice to sort of experiment a bit more and kind of get a load of mates involved from people that I've met over the years doing different stuff, and you know, just kind of gather people up and get proper musicians to play rather than I harness the power of my ignorance to do everything I do. But it's really great to sort of work with sort of proper grown-ups from time to time.
Who does your artwork, by the way? I love the artwork.
The latest Non-Canon and the most recent Oxygen and Thief albums, they were both done by a guy called John O'Gans. So I think he's just at John O'Gans on Twitter. He did the the artwork for a band called Doe, who I really liked, and for Happy Accidents as well. And so I was kind of just looking up artist Instagrams when I was working on an album on the Oxygen Thief 1 Confusion Species, and he had some kind of abstract stuff. He did quite a few different styles that he worked in, and one of them was this kind of abstract geometric thing.
Yeah, like they're screen prints, aren't they?
Yeah,
screen prints.
Yeah, I sort of really like that, and just kind of sent him the album and sort of said, I like this kind of art, but the actual what comes out of it is kind of down to you.
Yeah.
And the same with the non-canon one. The first album somebody else did, and so he the guy called Joe Watson, and he kind of did these kind of four. They were all like little kind of little symbols or sort of smaller images within that sort of made up a whole artwork. So I kind of again sort of suggested that we take that on as the theme, right. And then he could just kind of interpret that how he wants. So yeah, he's really fun to work with, I'm not a very like visual sort of art, but I love art, but I can't draw. I have no kind of real sort of, you know, visual art skills myself, so I'm really bad at kind of giving like, oh, I want it to be this, and you know, a devil riding a motorbike into the sun or what, you know, that kind of stuff.
a buxom lady on the back.
Yeah.
It's so hard, isn't it? Like, I mean, when you submit a record and like you've done all your creative work, right? So you've created something that's your interpretation of it. And then I've found that when I've done exactly the same thing and submitted to an artist, you just don't, it's not my forte. I'd rather it be their, do you know what I mean? It's for them to sort of get, it's their chance to interpret what you were getting at, you know? I find it so hard. But
it is really difficult.
People like Nick are amazing artists.
Yeah, that's kind of how we became friends. Warren's like a musician, and he asked me to do some artwork for him, and that's kind of how we became friends through that. But even like we do music together, and even that, I kind of think about that visually. Like fill a room, and it's all visual to me.
Okay.
Yeah. It's always, I've always found like, you know, like the end of a film, the credits and stuff. I'm that guy that I can imagine the end tune at the end of it. Do you know what I mean? It's sort of how I interpret the journey, I guess.
Yeah, I like that. So, when did you start doing music professionally then, Barry?
I suppose. Well, I mean, I still have a day job as well.
You do?
Because it's So I mean, semi-professionally, perhaps. But it's been something I've been doing. My first proper release was 2011, so it's coming up to 10 years. So I put an album out, which is Oxygen Thief, sort of fully acoustic, like all the sort of loudness that I've had done as a kid with other bands and stuff, but just kind of smashed out on an acoustic guitar and recorded in my house. And so, yeah, that sort of was out on a label, and, you know, had the CDs like properly printed rather than you know, running them off at the photocopier at work and cutting them up with scissors. So that was that kind of that first moment that I felt like I was kind of proper, you know.
That's amazing.
And then I think like the next turning point was signing with Extra Mile, because that then their roster is amazing. So just kind of joining the ranks of those people like Frank Turner and Beans on Toast and like Against Me and Crazy Arm, just all these great bands, Chris TT, who it's like feels like a seal of approval, you know. You can just I'm not just some dickhead who's making weird noise. I mean, I am also that, but not just that, you know. So yeah, that was 2013, I think. We kind of got together, as it were. We'd been sort of tangentially friends. Basically, I just played loads of gigs with loads of bands that were on the label or who ended up being signed to the label. Ben Marwood and Jim Lockie, we did a split, sort of three-way split album. We did three songs each. And then they both signed to Extra Mile a little bit after that. So I like to joke that I was sort of sat there refreshing my inbox, just being like, okay.
me.
Yeah, but it was nice. I mean, as a label, they are that sort of, it is like a big family kind of thing. So, it just, you know, just all fell into place quite nicely. But it doesn't mean that whenever anyone asks me like for advice about how to get sort of onto labels or anything, I'm like, just spend 10 years sort of making some nice friends, and then it will might happen, you know. It's not quite got the timescale for that.
I have to say, shout out to Charlie and Anthea at Extra Mile for starters, because they just signed my friend's band, Pet Needs, and they were on the podcast well over a year ago, and they'd kind of started talking to Frank, and they asked Frank if we could do like a live podcast at his Lost Weekend thing in Berlin, and then he said yes, which was just staggering, but obviously we couldn't do it because of the lockdown. But then I just thought I'll chance my arm and ask, you know, is there anyone who would be up for doing the podcast, and they just came straight through and helped me out. It's like Charlie answered the email straight away. They're amazing there, they really are.
Yeah, they're a great gang, and I think like there's always, I mean, this particular sort of subject matter as well, I think is important to everybody, and people are quite open about it. And the sort of stuff that was around Lost Evenings, they had sort of workshops about sort of health and mental health in the industry, and about kind of sexual violence and, you know, safety in the industry or at gigs and festivals and stuff. So there's always kind of that extra level of kind of engagement and stuff, and being involved in things. So yeah, they're sort of forward thinking like that. It's
that's great. Amazing though, you've got that opportunity. You could just kind of roll around going, well, this is brilliant, but they're actually using it for something good. I've got respect for that.
I think it's really important that like record labels in recent times have actually been very proactive in ensuring, like, you know, like even at like hardcore gigs and stuff, that girls in the audiences and stuff felt comfortable, and people were able to attend shows and not for not any fear of being ostracised or being bullied out of the situation. I mean, I remember sort of in the early 2000s, like at the drive-in playing and being around, sort of it was a confused audiences, wasn't it? Like people that they were greeted in England because it was very moshy and very sort of new metal vibes, you know.
And they were telling everyone to be nice to each other. And
exactly. Yeah, but then lots of like local.
That's a hardcore thing, though, isn't it?
Yeah, but you just don't have to be an arsehole, do you? You know, it's the fundamentals, and like a lot of, because obviously with Million Dead and those shows, like back in the day, were very respectful of everybody, and that sort of Extra Mile to have definitely taken on that ethos. I think, you know, it's beautiful.
Yeah. So how do you balance it then, Barry? If you've, because you've done some amazing gigs, like done the festivals, you've gone out and done, you know, kind of pretty much what I would love to do. How do you balance all that whilst working? Is that your holiday?
It was for many years, and up until fairly recently, I was I kind of took a step back from the being a permanent employee, and where I work, they have like a temp pool. So I spent about 4 or 5 years bouncing around various jobs like that, and being able to kind of plan the music stuff ahead, and just sort of, you know, so it wasn't actual holiday, it was just like, oh well, I'm not going to work those few weeks or that month and do music instead, and that was amazing. It was really sort of liberating to properly live sort of as a musician first in my brain, I think, rather than being like, oh, I'm an office worker that does this thing sometimes. Obviously pandemic just kind of has made that, I mean, for a start there's no music to do, can't tour, and the stability of all that kind of went up in the air, so I've had to kind of go back to sort of permanent employment again, but like I work with some cool people, and it's quite interesting work. So yeah, it's basically just sort of finding the time to do it, and sort of setting aside time, and you know, still making sure you actually see your wife and your family and friends and stuff as well. So yeah. it's been really good. I did have a year in 2014, I think. I took a career break. That was before I was doing temping. They actually had this scheme where you could just not go to work for a year and they wouldn't pay you or anything, but they'd keep your job open for you. So I just thought, I'll just see what happens if I just do music all the time. That was kind of the year that did a load of stuff with The Extra Mile. But I think it actually, to you know, foreshadow some of the mental health chat, it did drive me a bit mental as well, because it's a thing that I always thought about anyway. It's always on my mind in some way. But for that to be the only thing that I have to do, it was probably a little bit detrimental. So
really?
I found it just became kind of obsessive a little bit. So I've actually found that I quite like the balance of being having, like, well, I'm doing, you know, I've got my day job and that sort of keeps the roof over the head and food on the table, and music can be its own sort of thing, and it's not, you're not sort of having that kind of worry about sort of finances or what's coming up in the next wherever. It's just purely like, right, this is the music I want to do, let's see what happens, you know.
I remember, like, when I was, like, in my 20s, desperately trying to make it in a band, and I was a chef at the same time, and I'd work till 4 in a kitchen, and then I'd go to London and play a gig, and then you'd go and play a gig, and it would be amazing, and you'd be buzzy, and I'd get really drunk, and it would be, like, the best night ever. And then the next morning, I had to wake up at 8 o'clock to go and, you know, cut up meat or something in the kitchen. Yeah. And I used to hate it. It was like, this isn't what I should be doing. I should be rocking out. That's who I am. Mm. But now, because I'm kind of grown up and I've got kids, like, I still would love to go on tour, but I think I'd find it quite scary. Mm.
It's my favourite thing to do in music. Like, it's the reason that I write and record. I know some people write because they, you know, it sort of flows out of them, or people love the recording side of it more, maybe. Yeah. And the gigs can be sort of, you know, it's like the necessary evil, maybe. But for me, it's like live gigs have always been the thing that I've loved the most. Yeah. And the joy of, like, just or, you know, you get up and all you need to do is travel to the next place and play it's great. I was sort of reminiscing about the tour we did with Mongol Horde, Frank's heavy band, which was 7 years ago, coming up to 2014, and just, you know, 10 dates, just, it was my birthday during it, and we sort of, you know, 10 days in a row, get up, travel, play, have a bit of a drink, hang out with your mates, you know, next day, feel a bit gross, but carry on doing it, and just, you know, it's just, it's really great once you kind of get into the swing of things as well, and, you know, generally by the time you get to the end of it, you feel like, I'm just getting on top of it now, and then it ends.
I suppose it's like, if you're like, you know, like American bands will tour for like the best part of a year. Like, I bet that, you know, it loses its novelty after a while. It's got to.
Yeah, I expect so. The longest I've done is probably about sort of 18, 19 days or something like that I've been away from home. That was great. Obviously, I miss home, miss my wife, but the actual, sort of doing the music stuff, it's just, I think although I work with Extra Mile, it's still quite a DIY sort of mentality, so I tend to end up, you know, doing the driving and book the shows as well. You know, I've done tours where I've basically been tour manager and playing and driving and all that kind of stuff. So, towards the end of that time, you're just a bit like, I could actually do with an early night.
I had this conversation with Nick a little while ago about the... like, we did a stretch of shows, and then I went back from... I got a first train back from Newcastle to get to see my daughter's Halloween. She was a baby, like a Halloween like get together with her and her little nursery mate, and then did that. And it's the first time I'd seen my partner in 2 weeks. Then got back on the train, went to Stoke, played another 3 shows, and then come back for 1 day and go back. And by that time, you're back on the tour. And you kind of hate all your bandmates anyway because you're seeing them too much. You've been sharing a travel lodge. It's your turn to drive the splitter in the morning. The arseholes want to get out of bed. And it's like, I just want to be back home with my baby in the Halloween circle, feeling that shit. You know, it's an amazing dynamic, I think.
Oh, when I did it, like we would like maybe go for a week, like again off our own back. We'd get in a van and we'd like there was 6 of us in a band. Luckily, I couldn't drive at the time, which is perfect. But I ended up just hating everyone. Like every little thing someone would do, I would just hate them. I'd be sitting in the back trying to read, and if I was reading, someone got the arms. What are you reading for? So, because reading's good. I'd be like, wake up! Don't go to sleep. We're awake.
Yeah.
Oh, this is driving me mad. I was trying to get through the Hunter S. Thompson books, and no one would let me.
I've been pretty lucky, really. I think, the band, the 3 of us, that the Oxygen Thief, it's back to being just me because the other guys had to knock it on the head because they run a recording studio and they play in wedding bands as their day job as well, although obviously haven't this year. But the studio is getting really busy and Neil's got a few kids, so they just sort of said it's sort of time to step away from it. So we did one last show last January, which turns out was quite a lot of people's last gig that they went to, which was just sort of bittersweet. But those two work together in the studio. They play together in the wedding band, so they're like just this kind of double act. And they'll keep themselves, you know, entertained. Although if I want to have a nap, they'll just, you know, I fall asleep and they're talking and I wake up and they're still talking and it's all complete nonsense. But they're very used to that kind of, you know, chatting away on the thing, and then, you know, we'll listen to podcasts or I'll just join in with the nonsense and sort of going from there. The other stuff I've done when I've toured on my own is tend to like tour with either like supporting a mate or with a mate supporting. So we just have that kind of little support bubble and we kind of look after each other and keep each other entertained and DJ and things like that. So I am quite laid back as well, so it could be that everyone's super annoying and I'm just kind of bumbling along and having a great time because I'm just, you know, I try not to I just try and get on with people, really.
Do you find when like you all like roll out into a service station that you feel like a sort of motorcycle gang when you bowl in? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, there is that kind of like we're not just stopping off on a day trip somewhere, you know.
The stuff that should stay in the tour box, like all the stupid shit that you do, it then spreads out into the local service station. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. You're just kind of having to kind of edit yourself and try not to to infect the others with the madness.
In our band there was twins and they would have like rolling battles. You could pull up into a Granada and they would both go and steal things and then have a fight. And it was just constant madness. Because they never had no money because they didn't have jobs. So I was looking through some of the stuff you'd done before and you've been quite open about taking medication, Barry.
There's too much stigma around mental health anyway. I spent quite a number of years not really addressing it properly, I don't think, and just sort of powering through and having, you know, the odd down day or something, but just sort of, you know, talking it through with my wife or putting into sort of music stuff and just sort of channeling things and sort of skirting around it really and sort of managing it, I think. A few years ago, I think it was after I did the career break thing and I sort of went back to work after a year of sort of music stuff, and that was obviously depressing, but also during that time when I was kind of getting a bit over obsessed with it, I noticed things like the sort of buzz of good news was lasting less and less. I had the moment that I realised that something wasn't quite right was I was on tour. I was in Manchester, I think, and I'd had an email offering me a slot at, on the acoustic stage at Download Festival.
Yeah,
and I was like super pumped and really excited, you know, it's just one of those things that it was kind of in the background. It possibly could happen, but I just didn't hear anything back for ages, and then when it's finally confirmed, I was just like, brilliant, you know, I'm on tour, I'm going to do this. This is incredible. And then about half an hour after that, I was like utterly pissed off that I didn't have anything booked for August or something like that, you know. And I just completely lost all perspective about it. And so, yeah, that was kind of a bit of an eye-opener of, like, my brain isn't working quite right. And then, yeah, going back to work and sort of having the routine of stuff that you... I sort of rejoined the office at the same point in the year. So, like, I was doing the same thing that I was doing just before I'd left. So it felt like that whole year had been a weird dream. And so that all kind of compounded, and so that's when I sort of thought, right, I'll actually sort of do something about this sort of properly. One of the things with the non-canon lyrics is that I try to be sort of quite straightforward and quite open and quite honest with them. The Oxygen Thief things tend to be wrapped up in little kind of word games and, like, you know, sort of trying to skirt around and play with... the themes and topics of songs, whereas non-canon is much more like, right, this is what this is about, here is what's happening. And so the opening line on the second album is literally a true story. Like, I went to the doctor to renew my prescription. She asked me how things were working out, and I said, it's hard to, I think it's working, but it's hard to tell when the world is shit. And so I like that as like a kind of a story to sort of, you know, I swore at my GP. That amused me, but also I thought it's just quite a direct kind of introduction to the album. It is something that is been stigmatized for so long, and people are sort of wary of talking about it, maybe. I mean, that might be one of the sort of silver linings of the pandemic, I think, is that everyone just in daily life, it's like people that would never normally talk to each other about it are just, you know, people start conversations with, like, how are you? Like, really, how are you? And so hopefully that will kind of continue and people will carry on being sort of much more open and much more willing to talk and understand and be aware of other people's, that maybe people who haven't experienced things directly themselves will, they've had a taste of it, I suppose. They've had this kind of acute thing because of the situation that everyone's sharing. So, you know, maybe that will mean that their understanding of it will kind of carry on, I hope.
I had this weird kind of realisation that the lockdown... in many ways emulates depression. You know, like, kind of being indoors, not being able to do anything, or you know, like, when I'm really, really low, I don't want to do anything, and my motivation's, like, you know, through the floor. And I will just be isolated indoors, and then that becomes a problem in itself. When I'm really low, I don't really look forward to anything. And now everyone's forced into a position where there's nothing really to look forward to. And you're kind of forced into this kind of more insular environment. And it kind of feels like depression in many ways. And I think people can get a little bit of an insight into what it's like. Maybe a small amount, you know, from being indoors for so long, you get this rough idea of what being depressed is like.
Barry, do you spend a lot of time on your own working when you're, like, making music?
I do sort of pretty much everything myself. So I record a lot at home. The Oxygen Thief band stuff was obviously like in the studio with the guys, but then I do all the kind of backing vocals at home because I like to kind of experiment with them, and it's boring as hell for somebody to be, you know. But yeah, the non-canon stuff I recorded as much. Well, I recorded pretty much all of it at home. Went to a studio for the drums. Had people over to sort of do piano and sort of strings and things. But yeah, the actual kind of writing and rehearsing process is all me and my in our spare room, and or going to a rehearsal studio and kind of running through stuff. So
because interestingly, like with the whole like the recent lockdown stuff and that, I've worked on my own for, I don't know, 5-6 years, sort of doing production and music and stuff, and I found that having a common denominator with people in general now that are home alone and working from home and just working by themselves is making links of conversation easier with people I wouldn't necessarily have spoken to, and that's enabling people to be a bit more open about, this is a bit shit and I can't quite deal with certain things, you know. Because I'm typically a collaborator. It's like, well, I love my friends around me, but then those relationships become very open, and I'm very open with my feelings and the development of those relationships and people. It's just really interesting learning now about how people are working alone and dealing with it, I think. So that your other job, are you now obviously just based at home as well, right?
Yeah, I started a new post at the beginning of the year, so I've been doing all the training and induction and stuff completely remotely, which is kind of weird. You know, a whole thing in itself. Whereas before it was like people, you know, I'd go home, we went home from an office that I had been working in and was talking to people that I had met in real life. Yeah, it's all right. My wife is as well, so we sort of wake up in the morning, make breakfast, go to separate ends of the house, and you know, and then sort of go down, meet up for a cup of tea. So you know, it's quite nice in a lot of ways, because you know, hanging out a bit more and sort of catching up. Yeah, it's a bit odd. I mean, I seem to have been sort of locking into different projects that I've been I don't know whether they're coping mechanisms or what, but throughout the first lockdown, I sat and watched all of these Star Trek original series in the background while I was working on my laptop. And then after that, I listened to all my vinyl records from A to Z. Then in that weird bit, hinterland, when things were open a little bit and I was going back into an office, I listened to all my Bandcamp collection sort of as I was walking to and from the office, and now I've decided I'm going to do all my CDs from beginning to end. And I've got, I mean where are we, like the 18th of February, and I've just finished the Bowie section.
Nice.
Yeah, you posted Bowie stuff, that's why I commented today.
Yeah
I'm a big Bowie fan.
Yeah, man.
But it's I mean, I sincerely hope that we won't be in lockdown, or we won't be in these kind of restricted conditions for me to get all the way to Z in my CDs. But I think it's going to take some time to get through them. But it's quite an interesting experience to kind of revisit stuff in that way and not have to make that decision of what you're going to listen to, and you're just, you know, you're sort of working through things and sort of rediscovering things. But I do think it is something that like you say, we haven't got anything to look forward to, we haven't got anything to plan. I haven't planned any gig, people sort of talking about, you know, sort of booking tours for the autumn and stuff, and it's like, well, I don't feel like I can cope with the idea of cancelling stuff. You know, I had a couple of things penciled in, like really loosely, like really lightly for May, like back in September, I think that we were talking about that. But it was just literally like, if it feels like, and you know, obviously it's not gonna. And like cancelling, I was gonna go to Lost Evenings last year in Berlin as well, so we planned a tour sort of travelling there and back, and obviously that all got binned. And I don't quite have the mental capacity to sort of build up the excitement and planning and then sort of ditch it. But I think like having something organized like that I've got, I know what I'm doing each day. Yeah. I'm listening to these CDs. I'm sort of looking forward ahead in some things to, you know, oh, that'd be interesting in August when I get to M and can listen to all the Mannix albums, you know. So, yeah, I think maybe that's sort of linked. I mean, I'm taking photos of every T-shirt I wear every day and posting them in a thread. And
is that a Glassjaw T-shirt you've got on?
Yes, yeah.
They've just... Dude, I had that T-shirt years ago and I ripped it in a mosh pit. It's like, fuck.
Yeah. This is my second one of it. I didn't rip it in a mosh pit because I'm useless at mosh pits. But I wore it so much that the colour faded. It just became like scratchy cardboard.
Yeah,
horror. So I bought the same one again.
Yeah, man.
From their website.
I got the massive G's in like the rainbow colours.
Okay.
I wore that one on tour for like, I'd like play a show. Wear a different T-shirt next night, play another one, and it got to a point where it's got a bit cardboard like, you know.
Yeah, yeah. But I think that's, yeah, I wore it at gigs a lot as well. I think that kind of sweat corrosive things, I mean,
it's intrusive to band T-shirts.
That's funny, we were talking about sweating before we came on.
Yeah.
We spent about half hour talking about sweating and sharing tips on not sweating.
Yeah.
That could be an offshoot podcast where we
talk about wonderful
deodorant
reviews.
Yeah,
I think it sounds like a really lovely coping mechanism though, and it's something like I see my CD collection and it's like, yeah, I really like the idea of that. I might steal it from you.
No, go. I mean, please do. I will accept 10% of your likes and
brilliant.
As a kind of, you know,
I'll tag you in every post.
20 likes on that, I'm like, right, great.
Yeah,
two of them are mine.
Yeah,
fantastic.
It's a thing about achieving something, even if it's something really kind of simple, like you know, you watch, I've been watching all of the American Office again, and it's like you're kind of working towards something and that makes you feel a bit better.
Yeah, yeah, it's sort of, I suppose like social media has that kind of dopamine sort of response thing of, you know, which can get a bit unhealthy. But when it's something that is quite, it's just your own sort of little world and you're kind of working through that. And it's sort of prompting conversations with people and, you know, where people are kind of talking about whichever that's their favourite Bowie album or, you know, I listened to all the Blink 182 ones that I've got, and you know, we're sort of talking about sort of different people I know, obviously like different age groups and stuff. So where I came in around sort of an Enema of the State, and whereas they would have come in around the self-titled one. So you know, the sort of different perceptions we have of bands based on where in the discography we arrived with them, and which was the new album when it came out, and you know, which was your new album, that sort of thing. So it's like, you know, you've got all the memories of the gigs that you've seen of all these bands, and then also, you know, kind of interacting with people and chatting about various bits and bobs.
Getting recommendations, don't you, about these things?
Yeah,
it's like, yeah, no, I like Nirvana, Bleach era, you know, I liked them before Nevermind.
Yeah,
it's like, no, you didn't.
I think it's, yeah, I mean, I probably had my fair share of that kind of attitude and things, and but it's, I think maybe as you get older, you just start feel like you don't give a shit about that kind of stuff anymore. You're just like, okay, I'm going to listen to. So I've also, so my task of listening to all the CDs has been kind of enlarged, I suppose, by the fact that a mate of mine gave me all his CDs when he moved house, because they'd been in his loft for 10 years, and he didn't want to put them in another loft and then eventually have to put them in another loft, or, you know, have his kids throw them away in 50 years. I think hopefully that was giving him a reasonable lifespan. So I kind of, you know, ditched all the duplicates and stuff, but then I've got, you know, all these kind of extra things to listen to, and then there's like some random pop CDs that like I think were his wife's or his sister's that ended up in his collection and things, and so yeah, I'm like, I'm gonna listen to the All Saints album. I've never listened to that. They had some great songs.
I had
a bit of fun trolling people by saying that their original version of Under the Bridge is much better than Jimmy Pappas cover. But actually, after posting that as a joke, I think I actually do enjoy that version more these days. As a teenager, I was like, what's going on, boo?
Wasn't it kind of glitchy, wasn't it? It went...
Yeah, they had the little kind of record scratch kind of sample in there. But yeah, it's, I, you know, the things that you care about when you're younger and sort of obsessive and, I don't know, maybe you're kind of forging your own identity and you're kind of a bit insecure maybe, and you know, maybe that, I don't know whether that's an age thing or experience or just
yeah,
a random progression.
I was definitely that kid that was a bit like, I'm never listening to that sort of thing. So, oh, what a dickhead.
I still kind of, I really like Blink 182.
Yeah.
And I love the Neighbourhoods album loads. And I really, really, really like Angels and Airwaves.
Okay. What about Boxcar Racer?
No, I love Boxcar Racer. Was that transition.
Yeah, album was good.
Yeah, I listened to that earlier on. That was
and of course,
I looked at the back cover and was like, I recognise the first song.
Yeah.
I don't recognise any of the others. No. I don't remember ever listening to this.
No.
Then I put it on and like I knew about half of it. Like I was like, oh, okay, you know. And it is really good. It's a really good record.
Yeah, it's really well produced, right? It sounds amazing. Yeah,
there's quite a lot of auto-tune on Tom DeLonge's voice.
Yeah.
Because there's all these really long-held notes, you know, like, you can't do those. Can't do that.
I didn't think of that.
Yeah, totally.
Man. Angels and Airwaves has got loads of notes like that, Lynn.
Mm.
I love Angels and Airwaves. I went to see them once, and I was totally blown away. And I went outside to smoke a fag, and I was sitting down, because I tend to not like standing up. And a girl sitting next to me, some... that goth girl was. I started talking to her, and she lit up a joint. And I was like, "Let's have a bit of that. Let's have a bit of that." And then I saw security pass it back to her. She got busted and thrown out, and I bombed it back in. Properly stitched her up.
Oh,
bang it, brother. Yeah, I said to my mate, "I like Angels and Airwaves," and he's still like a snob, and he was going, "That's teenagers' music."
It is what it is, mate.
Well, Tom DeLonge's got to be like my age.
Yeah, probably.
Awful. So, when you went to the doctor's, Barry, coming back topic.
Got absolutely sidetracked.
Yeah, I don't mind. It's fine. So, what did the doctor just put you straight on medication?
I'm trying to think now. I think I had been for some counselling via my workplace as well, because they sort of provide that. And I think they kind of talked through what I wanted to do. I've had sort of counselling. I've not had like sort of proper structured therapy or anything. They asked me what I thought I wanted to do. I was kind of with the mentality of I thought that was what I wanted to do. You know, I sort of went there thinking that's probably the route that I'd like to take. They just sort of had a chat about that. It's quite a while ago now, so I can't really remember whether there was much discussion about which, you know, what to take or anything like that, but end up with fluoxetine, which is Prozac,
yeah,
the sort of generic term for that. Still been on it since, really, like just sort of started off at one of the, I can't remember how they, 50 milligram or one tablet a day, and then, you know, go through the side effects of sort of it kicking in, and then sort of went up to two, and then sort of bounced between that one and two a little bit over the years, sort of trying to sort of ease back a little bit just to see what would happen. Sometimes that's great, sometimes it's not, and it's quite, I don't know, I feel like there's sort of an expectation that people sort of set themselves that they will someday not be taking them, which I don't think, I mean, I've seen people writing about the fact that that's not, you know, that's not necessarily the end goal. If you do need it, then, you know, like any other condition that you have, if it's, you know, diabetics, they need to take insulin constantly. Yeah. They're not sort of working towards a day when they will can wean themselves off it. So I'm kind of open to it, really, just thinking, well, you know, if it's the right thing to do. I mean, I was feeling pretty decent sort of towards the end of last year, weirdly, even though it's everything's horrible. You know, having a new job to look forward to and less uncertainty with that, and also there being news about vaccines and things and just sort of starting to be able to see a future open up a little bit was quite interesting. So I sort of spent a month or so sort of dropped down a little bit, but then I noticed my mood was just went weird, you know. It just wasn't right. So
did
I
you notice quickly
picked it back up.
Like,
not it's, really
a lot of the time it's hard to be that self-aware.
Yeah, I think it's just sort of a mixture of kind of keeping an eye, you know, sort of trying to be aware of your own things, and also kind of having people around you, you know, having a wife or a partner or you know, somebody you know you're talking to that is going to notice. And so yeah, she sort of noticed that I wasn't, you know, as I don't know, not perky is the wrong word. I wasn't. I would be more tending towards not feeling great.
What occurred to me, you know, you were talking about when those kind of obsessive behaviours.
Yeah.
And normally, before I have a crash or a bad mental period, that normally comes after a period of that obsessive behaviour.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then my wife, she'll see it coming a mile off, and she's going, "You need to calm it down. You know,
yeah.
I'm getting concerned that you're going to have a crash." And invariably, I then have a crash, and then she's like, "Go to the doctors, get your medication changed." I've been through the gamut, really. But yeah, when you said that about having that kind of obsessive period, like I could see that in myself.
Mm. I think for another thing that it manifests for me is that I will just sort of lose any ability to be. To be happy for the success of others.
Yeah.
you see other people doing things, and like, because there's an ambitious drive that makes you want to do, you know, you want to write more better songs, you want to play more bigger, better gigs or festivals, or you know, do whatever. Generally, I'm happy with setting my own, you know. Working to my own standards, you know.
Yeah.
We're not all going to be Frank Turner, we're not all going to be, you know, insert name here. But I think, on occasions, I will just notice that seeing somebody, you know, just getting a bit of attention, you know, being retweeted by somebody else, I'll just get jealous of it, and in a sort of really ungenerous way. And it's not, I don't slag people off, I don't kind of, you know, kind of do anything about it. I just go, "Oh, bloody, what's Ginger Wildheart? Listen to their album and not mine, blah, blah, blah," even though we did, you know, all this kind of stuff.
I'm friends, Ginger.
Well, yeah, no, like, he retweeted something, like a friend's band, and loads of people started listening to it, and a bit of my brain was like, "Oh, no, no, no." And like, I know that that's wrong. Yeah. And so, like, the fact that that thought stayed in my head more than a second was like a warning sign, you know? I suppose, like, it's social media being kind of a thing that can, you know, can get too obsessive. Like, I tend to periodically delete the apps from my phone so that I'm not just like checking it constantly. And sort of level out and stuff. And so, you know, like, now I'm back to, you know, that kind of thrill of seeing your peers doing well, you know, despite the awful situation we're in, that there's still successes to be had, and that it's great that people are you know, releasing great music and doing these cool online shows and stuff, and that I can enjoy that for what it is without having that weird bit of your brain going, yeah, but why?
You've really hit upon something there. That is me. I do that. When I was younger, my friends would be like, oh yeah, Nick, yeah, he's a bitter bastard. It was just this idea that I was always really bitter. And I was. And I was bitter because I was mentally unwell. And you know what? I think you've just done me a massive favour there to kind of recognise something in myself. That when I start becoming bitter, that I'm starting to go downhill.
Yeah, it's not, you know, some people are just miserable pricks, but it's, you know, but like when that's not your normal situation, when it's not your, and when, you know, it's so, you know, sometimes there will be situations where you can justifiably think like, oh, well, I've done X, Y, and Z, and it hasn't led to whatever technically comes after Z. And other people maybe have skipped straight from A to Z, and you know, and it sort of pisses you off and things. But it's when it's like irrational, I think, is when it's just completely sort of self-defeating, and it's people that you like, and, you know, and it doesn't. I mean, yeah, what good is it going to do to sort of stew in the sort of idea of, oh, why am I not more blah. But it's, that's, I think that's the sort of pattern recognition and also the loss of perspective. I think that I lose perspective on things, and the fact that I, you know, I'm not doing something, it is something that, sort of outwardly and also, in terms of ambition, you always kind of want to do better than you've done before. You know, each year should be better than the year before, or each song should be better than the one before. So if you kind of get into a point where, I mean, there's going to be a natural plateau at some point, and like, you know, you can't, every gig cannot be like, you cannot play better or have a better audience reaction and sell more merch and have a nicer time every single time, because at some point you will have the most fun you could possibly have. You know, and there is a ceiling to these things,
isn't it? I find that I go through like serious bouts of depressive anxiety, wake up with knots in my stomach, and then I think what I've found that's really nice is that when you can recognize your own achievements, I stop worrying about what other people are doing and be like, actually, I am all right, and then getting out of bed suddenly day by day gets a bit easier. I think that's really important. Like, I mean, you've achieved so much if you think about what you've done, right? And it's so lovely. It's such a lovely thing that you've been able to do this. And no matter, we all build up walls, and we all build up. I personally have suffered massively from that. And when you can look around and go, I've got a lovely family, I've done all of this lovely stuff, it's quite helpful, I think, and through plenty of counselling I've had and chatting to friends and using my friends in a really open way, like having those conversations and being really supportive is I personally think just the most important thing. I really do, to help you.
It's that thing that I've gone through in therapy, and I have to constantly remind myself, is that you know, like, you shouldn't compare yourself to others, because you've got no idea of what they're going through, for starters. But the main point being is that if you're looking to others to make you feel good about yourself, then you fucked it. You got it wrong. Because that is a complete false errand, and it doesn't work.
Yeah. It's there's got to be a balance, hasn't there? And it is weird that, I don't know about you guys, but the fact that not being able to do gigs, like normally if I didn't play for a couple of months, then I would, it would, there's just something that in me that just needs to do it. And so the fact that I've not been able to, and it's just everyone can't, I think maybe that's been a little bit easier to bear, but also it just feels like a chunk of my identity is sort of out the window.
Yeah,
like,
totally.
This thing that I've done, you know, I haven't gone without playing a gig for more than 2 or 3 months in 15 plus years, maybe. You know, there's always something, you know, so it's that kind of, like it's a bit of your soul or whatever is just not sort of there at the moment. And also it's difficult to sort of contextualize that in the fact that, you know, people are out there dying and being seriously ill,
yeah.
And you're like, oh, I can't do the thing that makes me feel nice. It's, you know, but it's you've got to kind of balance that and recognize that it is still valid to be down.
Yeah,
about
you've still
stuff.
Lost something.
Yeah.
It's exactly that. It's
and
a,
it makes
it's
you
like
feel
grief,
good about
right?
yourself, doesn't it?
Yeah.
It's like that instant, you know, if you're playing well and you've worked hard to do
even,
songs. And
even
that.
Being in a room with others smashing a guitar about, like, for me, doing that on a Tuesday and a Thursday night in a loud room, it just does something. It's intrinsic. It's in your blood, you know. And
it's a release, isn't it?
It's like going to the gym, yeah. Sort of thing, you know. It's up here too. Screaming your lungs out. It's all of you. And to not do it, it's fucking... Do you know what I mean? You got to find solace in silence almost. And it's difficult.
Though. Yeah. I did some recording. I did a covers EP just before Christmas, which was... So, like, I'm reissuing my first Oxygen Thief album on vinyl this year.
Amazing.
Because it's the 10th anniversary. So, as a sort of thank you type thing and also something to do, I've been doing kind of these extra little sort of things to sort of include with the download.
Yeah.
So like gathered up all my old pre-album demos and, you know, the ones that I was cutting up with scissors and, you know, putting together myself and put that as a download. And so I did this EP of covers and recorded most of it at home, but then went to one of those pirate studios, you know, where you kind of like dial in and whatever, book it online. So they've got like some basically vocal booths. So I went there and just spent a few hours yelling, just so that not to disturb the neighbours and you know, family and stuff. So so that was great. That was really sort of cathartic and fun.
I listened to your Jailhouse Rock Killing in the Name of.
Oh, yeah.
Nice.
Totally works, doesn't it?
yeah, that was in my head as basically a joke. I would like yell at people, like, I don't know, the fact that the words fit each other got in my head, and I used to scream Jailhouse Rock at people in rock clubs. So like it had been in my head to do it for about 10 years before we got around to doing it. It's super fun.
Coming back to mental health, did you ever like kind of get to grips as to why you felt that way? Like anything outside of just feeling that way?
Not really. I think there's... I mean, I've always been quite a thinky, you know, I've sort of quite always been in my head as a sort of growing up. I used to sort of write a lot and kind of fixate about, you know, worry about things and get kind of, you know, angsty as a teenager, I suppose, which never really went away. My parents split up when I was like 16, and that sort of turned me into a proper little emo, emo zone. I don't know if that was necessarily a catalyst or a cause or anything like that, but it certainly sort of like shaped that kind of age, you know, that period of my life.
Yeah, my parents split up when I was like 20, and supposedly at 20 I've got it all together, and it was only really later on I realised how much it actually really did hit me.
Yeah, it was, you know, like it sort of, you know, soured my sort of view on a lot of things, and like my wife and I had been, like, I was basically adamant that I would never get married because I was just like, it was pointless. It was like, what's the point in doing a thing when you can just blah, blah, blah. And it, you know, like that, it took quite a long time. I think we were together for about 8 years before I kind of got my brain around the fact that it's just that doesn't necessarily need to define it. You know, I went to a lot of other weddings, saw that they were fun, and, you know, that the sort of, I don't know, just kind of got sold on the idea, I think, by it being, by seeing it happen and it being a lovely thing. And instead of it being an expectation sort of put onto you, you know? So yeah, I think that that was something that was kind of pivotal. But I don't think there's, you know, I think it's just, I don't know. I assume that it's like there's like a, you know, a bit of an imbalance, or there's a tendency towards that sort of mode of thinking. And that for some reason it will just,
we do have a tendency to go that way. It's funny because, like for myself, I can kind of make sense of things that have happened and things that have moulded my thinking. And then I've spoken to other people on the podcast like over the years, and they've been very much, well, no, nothing was bad. It was, it's a chemical thing, and that's it. And then I'll talk to them, and then I'm like, you've had a really hard life. You know, it's kind of like, it makes sense to me. But it's, I suppose it's however you put things together.
Yeah, and how you cope with things. Like, I, for the longest time, I didn't really talk to people about any time I felt low. Through uni and stuff, like my my way of coping with that would be to kind of be more more extroverted, you know, let's go out, let's do stuff, let's play gigs, or let's go clubbing, or let's go drinking, or, you know, go out, do stuff. So when I know people who are the other way, like when they're low, they need to not do stuff, or they're anxious, that was sort of a bit difficult for me to really understand. And also I kind of thought that putting everything into music, you know, people would hear it and understand, and they would sort of, whereas they don't, people, you know, people don't, you know, your family hear, you know, your parents hear like a song you wrote as a teenager about how awful it was for you at when, that time, and they're like, that was a nice song.
They're not like, really listening.
I like that one. Why don't you play that one at, you know, on Christmas Day when you come over? Like, I'm not going to do that. That's awful.
And you probably only got a small percentage of fans, even. Like, people who listen to it more widely will be like, I can hear where you were coming from there. Because we all kind of bring our thing to it.
Of course you do.
I mean, you think like all the Rage Against the Machine fans that are like ridiculously right wing and yelling "fuck you" or "don't do what you tell me" about wearing masks or supporting Trump or whatever it was.
People
don't. I mean, if you want people to know what you're thinking, you kind of have to tell them. I think at the end of the day, and I think that's that's sort of why I've got been more direct with the non-canon stuff, is that.
You literally have to put it in there.
I just kind of wanted to be sort of honest and kind of, you know, sort of, I don't know, just sort of put it out there, really. And not hide behind a, you know, because, and I think things are, you know, things like this podcast and various other kind of initiatives and charities and stuff, there's so much more awareness and like, I mean, last night I had a chat with some mates that I've not seen. We were a band together when we were at Sit Form, and, you know, we're like brothers, you know, as you are. You're just like constantly bickering and sort of hanging out and, you know, in each other's pockets and stuff. But I don't think we ever really had a serious conversation about how we were for those 3 or 4 years. But we sort of got back together because one of them's going through some stuff, and we thought we'd actually, you know, have a catch up and, you know, sort of have give him the chance to sort of talk to talk it through, or just, or whatever you wanted, really. And so that's, you know, that's not a kind of conversation that I ever thought that the four of us would have had. You know, it was always just dick jokes and farts. That was basically 100% of our relationship before. So it's really nice to be here like 20 years later and being able to be like really open with people you've known for all that time.
It's so true. Like, when I started doing this podcast and being really, like, really open and honest about my own issues, friends that I had, I'd be talking about my teens, and everyone thought, oh yeah, Nick's always wankered, he's a right laugh. And it's like, and now they realise why I was always really drunk and taking all the drugs.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, I'm so sorry I wasn't there for you. It's like, well, no, no, none of us talked about any of this stuff. You know, it's not you.
I think that's like the positive, you know, like seeing the positives and things. And like, I think, like, I learn a lot from younger people, you know, about all sorts of stuff.
Yeah,
like, you know, when it's the kind of social justice issues and sort of, you know, trans rights and racism and things, that there's always, I'm, you know, sort of quite aware that people are sort of coming up and sort of rewriting the rule books for those kind of things. I think it doesn't feel so much like I don't know, I don't really feel like I learn from like older people, you know. I think there's a point where you, like with your parents, you sort of, they start off by kind of telling you things like, you know, you have to do this because I said so, and you know, if you ask why, it's like, well, I said so,
that's how it is.
This is how it is. And then I don't know whether it's a thing that they in losing that power, they sort of rail against the things that are suddenly, you know, you can't say anymore, all that kind of stuff. But I don't know, like, I feel like the older I get, the more I want to learn and the more I want to to sort of empathize with others, and you know, I'm more and more willing to accept my own ignorance about more or less everything.
There's a beauty in the fact as well that there's a lovely transparency that's coming through from people, like just being honest about who they are, like quite young as well, and getting together and being and supporting one another, and that is something I didn't have growing up. Everyone ostracizes each other naturally.
I agree,
and it's beautiful, and it's enabling us to learn. Being older, it's lovely.
And then there's more, you know, like as a teenager, I suppose, like that was, I mean, I've been watching It's a Sin recently.
It's amazing.
Tomorrow. We're deliberately watching it week by week rather than on all four. But like, I remember like Queer as Folk being around when I was a kid or teenager or whatever, but I wouldn't have watched it then. Like, I wasn't what I would consider like homophobic or anything, but I think just in that kind of casual teenage boy way where you're like, I remember not going to see the full Monty with my friends because I was like, why do I want to see a thing about blokes taking their clothes off, you know? So there's kind of like sort of toxic things that you kind of recognize when looking back, but at the you know, at the very least, it means that you've got loads more sort of entertainment and more experiences and more richer stories to sort of experience and build up more empathy and understanding about sort of people and, you know, obviously artwork.
I remember watching Queer as Folk, and like, that's a really good show. Like at the time, it was really, really good, and just desperately thinking, like, oh, I hope I don't get aroused. I was really scared that I was going to get aroused, because I was always frightened I was gay for so many years, just because I wasn't as like manly as everyone else.
But it's, so detrimental to have that as a thing in your brain, isn't it? You know, and so
it's mad because like I've always thought that if you're open enough to experience and want something, right? So if I've always sort of said if I happen to see a man that I was attracted to or whatever they may be, I would never stop myself ever always. And that was from like being sort of late teens, I guess.
See, I think that's really cool.
Yeah.
Mm.
But I think like you're 10 years younger than me, and I think like that might have a lot to do with it.
Yeah, I'd potentially. Be but me and my friends still had that same mentality of like, you know, taking a piss out of one another. None of us were homophobic or anything, but it was there was still there. But that's just naive, the unknown, uncertainty, I guess. But I think there's. I don't know. It's weird. I've sort of grown up around lots of different types of people, and it's enriching, isn't it?
Yeah, I've been to like loads of gay clubs and things. And
no, I mean, mate, if you don't want to dance to gay disco,
they're the best nights out.
Yeah, exactly. This is it.
It was funny, the other day I went to the chip shop with my son. My son's 10 and he's got autism. Everything's very black and white. And he was saying this program that he's watching, The Last Airbender. It's like an anime thing. And there's a gay character in that. And he was going, like, that he thought it was really good that there was a gay character in it. And I just said, well, dude, you know, if you're gay, you know, like, that's all cool and no one's going to judge you for it. And he just went, well, I don't really think about those things. Like, it's just completely non-judgmental. It's just, don't think about those things. Straightforward.
And hopefully that is a thing that will continue, that, you know, because it is, like, the fact that people are better represented. And I didn't really realise until relatively recently how damaging the kind of Section 28 stuff was.
Yeah. I didn't know until, like, that programme.
No, and, like, it's that, like, oh, okay, so, you know, it, when you think back, you're like, realise, oh, no, it wasn't ever really discussed in school. And and for the fact that kids growing up are acknowledged that it is, like, it's just a normal part of life and it's how people are, it must be, you know, it must be really kind of liberating and stuff. It's nice to be hopeful from time to time.
In my previous job, I worked with lots of, like, kind of teenagers, and alright, the kind of the more butch blokes, which they'd call each other gay and then they'd want to beat each other up for it, but that was only kind of on the surface. Generally they were incredibly open minded and they just weren't really interested. They just didn't, nothing was an issue.
It's a cool thing, it's amazing.
We're over the hour.
We are. It's been a lovely chat, Barry.
Yeah, it's been great. I know I could can ramble on and go on, you know, sort of detours and things. So but it's been really interesting to chat. And like we said, like, the more that people do talk about things, and the more awareness is the better, really. And kind of, you know, the awareness of how everyone's stories are so different as well. You know, it's not one experience, is there? It's kind of unique and complicated.
Yeah.
Thanks so much, Barry. Thank you. I'll let you know when we release. Cheers. And yeah, I'll stay in touch. Thanks so much.
Cheers, buddy.
Cool. All right. Cheers.
Bye.
Cheers, brother.
Bye.
Bye bye. This.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. Hello Fresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. Hello Fresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at hellofresh.com.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.